theology proper started by learning the incommunicable attributes of God. So we call those the attributes of God's greatness, things like immortality, spirituality, aseity, eternality, infinity, simplicity, immutability, impassibility. Remember all those things? That seems like a long distant past. But we did go through all that. And then extending from the incommunicable attributes of God are the communicable attributes, those which are communicated to us. So the attributes of God's goodness. And that's the study we're in now, talking about the goodness of God. This is how he makes himself known to us, by which he communicates to us or shares with us his nature. So as much as our minds have kind of really been blown through the incommunicable attributes of God, things like divine simplicity or infinity or eternity, when our finite minds try to wrap our heads around, we just can't do it. It's an incomprehensible, ultimately fundamentally incomprehensible to us. But as difficult as those things are to grasp, it's interesting to see how it's really the communicable attributes that involve the greater degree of mystery and incomprehension, the attributes of God's goodness. Anybody, when you think about the attributes of God's goodness or communicable attributes, can anybody name some of those? Name them? Omniscience? That's not a, no, communicable attribute. So he doesn't communicate his omniscience to you, Jesse, even though you do think.
Mercy?
Mercy. That would be a communicable attribute of God. Attribute of his goodness. Yeah, thank you. What's that related to? Mercy. What?
Grace.
Love. Yeah, love. Mercy is an extension of his love, a deeper attribute of love. Yeah, good. What?
Grace.
Grace and mercy both extended out of his love. Yeah.
Faithfulness.
Okay, faithfulness, that comes out of his truth, his knowledge. Good. Others?
All the fruits of the Spirit.
Okay, fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Those fruits of the Spirit are extending out of the communicable attributes of God. That's why they are fruits of the Spirit. If you want to test someone's profession of faith, if they say they're a Christian and you don't see any of those fruits growing in their life, you have good cause to question whether or not they're Christians. They can have all the doctrine that they want to, but if they're not growing in those fruits, that's a good question. And you ought to think about that for yourself. If I don't see the fruits of the Spirit growing out of me, I have a good cause to question. No matter what I say I believe, no matter what my history is, I've got good reason to ask, am I truly a Christian if I don't see any fruit growing? Fruits of the Spirit, so they're divine fruits. They're divinely produced. Good. So, glory, the glory of God, the blessedness of God, those are communicable in a sense. We'll talk about that. Truth, knowledge, wisdom, we've gone through some of that. Beneficence or love of God that are manifest in mercy and grace and patience. So here's a question. As human beings, what provides our first introduction to the attributes of God? Do we come to know God through the incommunicable attributes first or through the communicable attributes first? Explain your answer. What do you think? How do we come to know God first? Okay, explain your answer.
He said, for God so loved, in John 3:16, for God so loved the world, and since he loved us, he reached out to us and he chose us. And that's an extension of love and mercy and grace. We just speak about that.
Okay, good. So John 3:16, all of us know that verse for good reason. That is a seminal verse. And it is all about the love of God. Josh, you're going to...
The love of God, and just even earlier than that, when we first breathe, we're experiencing...
What are we experiencing of God when we breathe?
Or life.
life, which is which comes from, well, and that is flowing from his incommunicable attributes, that he himself has life in himself. But that's not what we're cognizant of. What we're cognizant of is his communicable attribute, which is an attribute of what? Common grace, right?
Yeah.
Common grace. We all breathe. The righteous and the unrighteous all breathe. We all breathe the air that God provided with the lungs that he gave us. Scott and Ryan?
Okay. Well, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you can understand his incommunicable attributes to the fullest extent unless you experience his communicable, like, by being saved.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
You can't. And we can't fully understand it all. Any of those attributes and fully comprehend them all anyway because of our finiteness, right?
But it would have to be like first the communicable, right?
Absolutely, that's right. That's what we're saying, yep.
Back to Romans 1:20, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made.
Okay, his invisible attributes communicated through the things that are made, his eternal power and divine nature, okay? So his eternal power, is that communicable or incommunicable?
Incommunicable.
Incommunicable, right? But they're clearly perceived through what? Through the eyes, through the creation, through the senses, through the mind, all of it given by his common grace. So we can't help but by his communicable attributes to know and have an entrance into the knowledge of God. And everybody has that knowledge of God, as Romans 1:20 says. Everybody has it, whether a believer or an unbeliever. It's just the unbeliever suppresses what he knows. Okay, good. So we come to know God through his communicable attributes. So it's important to see that the communicable attributes of God that we've waited, you know, we had to study the incommunicable attributes as a foundation of God's essence, and we're building off of that to talk about his communicable attributes. But it is through the communicable attributes that we come to know all the attributes of divine glory, as Scott's saying. So it's because of the communicable attributes, in fact, that we're not utterly crushed or disintegrated by the weight of the divine essence. Think of a father playing with his young son, okay? Teaching his son how to play a sport like football. The father, by comparison to his son, is powerful, he's tall, he's coordinated, he's experienced, he's in control of himself. The son, by contrast, a young son, is small, he's relatively weak, his eye-hand coordination, his muscle memory are without experience, without training, without honing. He's uncoordinated, so his actions and reactions are unskilled and clumsy. So when playing football with his son, the father could crush his son, couldn't he? He could smother him. Every time he gets the ball, he could just run right over his son. Touchdown! Yeah! Spike it in the end zone. His son writhes on the ground with a footprint on his face, right? The rack up the score if you wanted to.
Way to teach yourself.
Some of you guys have done that, I guess. Make you feel like a man, does it? Yeah. But to play with his son and to teach his son, the father dials it down a bit, doesn't he? Quite a few notches. He restrains his power, he controls his strength, he doesn't make full use of his skill and experience, he doesn't dominate his son. Instead, what does he do? He enables his son, he helps him, he brings him along, he throws the ball, and when the kid drops it, he picks up, puts it in his hand, and then he says, run that way. You know, he runs that way, and the father cheers as he gets into the end zone, right? Why does he do that? To help him learn and grow? The fundamental question here is, why? Why does a father do that? What are the restraining forces that govern the father's play with his son?
Well, the father has a bigger view of things.
Okay, who said something over there?
I said love.
Okay, love. That's the answer in Sunday school is always love or Jesus Christ.
Or Jesus Christ.
You're saying?
Yeah, well, father has a bigger view of things. In other words, he knows his son's not going to be 3 years old forever. He's going to grow up. He's going to be a man. He knows there's things he must learn, and he knows there has to be a foundation for those things to learn. So he takes him where he's at, and he moves him along. And when he's 9, he plays him differently than when he's 5, and so forth and so on. But he's always there with him, and his motivation ultimately is love.
His motivation, all of that, that big perspective thinking. Because with that big perspective thinking, he could still crush his son, right?
Yep.
He could still destroy him, dominate him, roll over him. But he's not thinking that way. Why? Because of love. So explain, unpack how love determines how you're going to use your strength, your size, in teaching your... You have two sons.
I think it's love. It's the nurturing aspect. It's the care. It's wanting to see them succeed, setting them up for... the ability to produce later,
right,
and encouraging them, you know, where they're at.
So think about that. Love is restraining. Is you know, his sons, Hayden and Grant, were not the size they are now when they were 2, 3, but Brad's been this size for a long, long time. And think about the love that restrained that size in helping his sons grow up and become men. That's love restraining the muscles, love restraining the skill, the experience, using it for a different effect than winning, using it to teach, to train, to grow. In a similar way, and by a really rough analogy, that's how God is toward us. That's how he is toward us. It's God's incommunicable attributes, which are in union with his communicable attributes, but God reveals them all to us in such a way so as not to destroy us or undo us. The weight of God's essence, the awesomeness of his glory, they're channeled through one of the chiefly known, but I think most poorly understood of his attributes, the love of God. That's where we're going here, okay? And I'd like to illustrate this through a couple of texts. We're gonna spend time in these texts and I'd like to illustrate this through God's dealing with a couple of men in Scripture, Moses and Elijah. So if you've got your Bibles, let's start with Moses, and I'd like you to turn to a text that we've talked about a good bit. It's Exodus chapter 34. Exodus 34, 5 through 7. And it's from this foundational text, and I want to highlight something, what's really an early... highly concentrated revelation of God's communicable attributes to Moses. When Moses asked God, back in, you can look at Exodus 33:18, Moses asked God, please show me your glory. Anybody remember what preceded this scene right here? What happened before Exodus 33:18?
The golden calf.
Okay, golden calf, yeah, thank you. So the golden calf incident. Before Exodus 33 is Exodus 32, golden calf, blatant idolatry, rampant immorality, all through the children of Israel. It's awful. It's awful to see that. They're acting out in the desert, they're dancing around like pagans, dancing around a golden calf and getting into pagan revelry. God's wrath is hot. He is ready to wipe the descendants of Abraham off the map. You think Iran and all the nations around Israel now are, you know, want to destroy Israel. God is ready to annihilate them. Genocide, gone. He's ready to do that now. And then Moses intervened in Exodus 33. He implored God to spare the people for the sake of his own glory. He prayed, and then after he prayed, Moses went forth as a judge. I don't know if you remember that, but there at the end of the scene there, he strikes down all those people who continue in their sins. Strike, he tells the Levites, strap on your sword, we're going to go through every man killing his neighbor and his brother, his relative. This is, guys, you have to put yourself back in there to see, this is a horrific scene. The rampant idolatry, this immorality, this revelry, this party going on, and that stark contrast of the glory of God coming down on Sinai, Moses receiving the law, he comes down and he sees this, and then he's got to go strap on his sword and actually do some killing. It is a terrible, terrible scene. Revelry followed by blood. So he goes through, strikes his own people down in order to end this plague that God had sent on the people. He had to cut out the cancer before God would do the healing. God, after this incident, think about your leadership there. Think about what your, if God tasks you to lead these people into the promised land, you're going to feel pretty dejected, aren't you? God still expected Moses to lead the people. Moses continued to judge the people. He continued to mediate for them, intercede for them. But this, for him as a man, became burdensome because Moses didn't know whether or not God would remain with them. That was an open question at this point. Moses is weary here of the burden of leadership. He's trying to lead a stubborn and stiff-necked people. So as Moses is pondering the future of his leadership, he told the Lord in Exodus 33:13, you can see it there, "Now therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways, that I may know you," in order to find favor in your sight. Sounds a bit like Paul there, doesn't he? God promised in verse 14, this is what he needed to hear, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Moses said, "That's good, because if your presence will not go with me, don't bring us up from here." I mean, almost just like, let us die out right here. I don't even want to go forward. So that's the context of Moses' request, Exodus 33:18. "Please show me your glory." And God replied to him. He said, "I'll do that. I'll make all my goodness pass before you. I'll proclaim before you my name, the Lord," or Yahweh. So divine glory here is manifest in divine goodness. That happened in the very next chapter, Exodus 34:5-7. The Lord descended on the cloud, stood with him there, proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, it says there, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. In that section right there, just quickly, what attributes of God do you hear revealed in those verses?
Holiness.
Sure. Holiness, okay, your holiness.
Justice.
Justice, okay, good, because he's not going to let any sin go unpunished, right?
Faithfulness.
Faithfulness, it says it right there, right?
Mercy and grace.
Gary first?
Yeah, mercy and grace.
Mercy and grace, yeah. Okay. Who else said something?
Steadfast love.
Steadfast love, mercy, grace.
Gentleness.
What's that?
Gentleness.
Gentleness.
Patience.
Patience, good. Okay, good. So God here has every right to command Moses' obedience, right? Without any explanation. He is the sovereign of the universe. He could just say, "Silence, Moses. Get up on your horse, get on the saddle, and get going again." He could, but he doesn't do that. He condescends here to reveal his glory to Moses, to grant Moses' request, to communicate himself. So you've got mercy, grace, patience, forgiveness. All those are extensions of God's love. You got steadfastness, faithfulness, all qualities grounded in divine immutability, the fact that he does not change. Faithfulness also is an extension of God's truth, justice, the execution of righteousness, the outward expression or explicit standard of God's holy character. So you guys mentioned all those attributes I just went through. And again, don't miss the fact that when Moses asks the Lord, "Please show me your glory," this is how God revealed himself, like this. By contrast, I said, God didn't silence Moses with a command. He didn't overwhelm Moses with another awesome, like, post-Exodus display of omnipotent power. He didn't blast Moses with divine light, reduce him to disintegrated jelly with his holiness or something like that. He instead, God here lovingly acquiesced. He revealed attributes of goodness in response to Moses' request. "Please, show me your glory."
He didn't show him his glory, because Moses couldn't take his glory. It's like, you know, "You can't handle that, but I will show you my goodness."
Well, what I'm trying to say is that
what he could handle.
Yeah.
And more than he asked for, actually, in many ways.
Well, the point I'm trying to make, though, is that when he says, "Show me your glory," he says, "I will show you my glory. Here it is. And it's through this."
Yes.
It's through goodness.
Through goodness.
So the glory of God, now when you're talking about this effervescent, light, blazing glory, mm-hmm. that's a manifestation of the essence of God. Yes, he didn't show him that and completely disintegrate.
Right.
What he did show him is another aspect of his glory. Okay? So he showed him an aspect of his glory in the revelation of his divine goodness. So it's still his glory. But it's something, you might say a filtered glory. It's a glory that's just as clear as the shining of light. Okay?
If God did not have glory, he could not show his goodness, though.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is that goodness is an aspect of God's glory, just as light is an aspect of God's glory.
Right.
By virtue of the fact of divine simplicity, that all these attributes are one, this is God's glory. The fact that it's not an overpowering, overwhelming, stomping, crushing weight of holiness does not make it any less the glory of God. It is the glory of God in his goodness, just as there is the glory of God in his greatness, as we talked about before.
So we're back to the Father playing football, essentially.
You got it. That's right. Gary?
I was thinking the other thing that strikes you is all those are communicable attributes. And I think, again, it's a revelation to us that if we're going to be in leadership, we have to be displaying those as well.
Yes. Exactly. That I'm so thankful you said that. This is exactly what we need to pick up on. This is exactly what we need to pick up on. Okay, so hold that thought. We're going to come back to it because I want to go over to 1 Kings 19. Just hold the thoughts of Moses in your head and go to 1 Kings 19.
1 Kings what?
19. 1 Kings 19. Okay? This is Elijah. He's had a similar experience with the glory of the Lord, okay, here in 1 Kings 19. Okay, so again, remember, you may not be as familiar with Elijah's life as you are with Moses' life, but remember what just happened in the previous chapter. So Moses had to deal with the dancing around the golden calf, an unfaithful Israel before a golden calf. What is Elijah dealing with? Unfaithful Israel again, dancing around the Asherah poles and the statues of Baal. Okay, so Elijah, in the previous chapter, he just met the 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah, and meeting them on Mount Carmel. And all the people of Israel that are able to come are around this scene. You remember Elijah squared off with all these prophets? I mean, there's almost 1,000 men, right? 1,000 prophets. God answered by fire from heaven. Okay, I won't go through the entire story, but he answered by fire. This display of immediate judgment. Elijah, then, after this display of judgment, of him consuming the sacrifice, what did Elijah do? Again, it's very Moses-like. He commanded the people to slaughter the false prophets. And it's only after purifying the people, it's not just a euphemistic way of saying this, but it sounds euphemistic to say that purifying meant executing the false prophets. I don't want to make a comparison and so diminish the glory of God or anything like that, but do you know that when ISIS was running rampant before we sent a lot of troops over to Syria and kind of helped to suppress ISIS, which is on the rise again. But remember when ISIS is going through and destroying old pieces of art and all that kind of stuff? You know what they're doing? Purifying. When they go into Saudi Arabia and blow up something, you know what they're doing in their minds? Purifying. They're looking at what they think is an unfaithful form of Islam, and they're trying to purge the unfaithfulness out of Islam. I'm not trying to commend ISIS, okay? I want to say that clearly on the recording here. But I'm trying to say that I think here in our country, we don't understand the weight of some of this. And we think about Elijah saying, grab those prophets, don't let them escape, slaughter them now. That's some pretty horrendous stuff. Moses and the Levites strapping on the swords and purifying by killing them. This is not something that we in the church, right, Gary?
Correct.
Gary, Mark? Not something we in the church do, okay? This is not for us in the church age. But listen, he purified the people. And the Lord then, what did he do right after this? He blessed the land by sending rain. The heavens had been shut up for 3 years, a total drought for 3 years, judgment on the land, and God blessed, once the land was purified and the people were repentant, the Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God, God sent rain in response to Elijah's prayer. After this scene, Elijah is physically and spiritually depleted, and in weakness, he fled from the threats of Jezebel. She's angry because her prophets are dead. So Elijah runs. What do you have to run from, you know? You can tell. For my own protection, I will not respond to that. Hell hath no fury, right? That's right. But he fled in his weakness. I mean, he had just had this mighty victory up on Mount Carmel, and now he flees in weakness from the threats of Jezebel. He's in a state of physical depletion, spiritual exhaustion, and in that condition, Elijah has become extremely discouraged. And so God here in 1 Kings 19 restores him. He restores him first physically and then spiritually. God sent the angel of the Lord, I believe is a pre-incarnate Christ, to minister to him, to feed him, replenish his physical strength. And he was strengthened by the food that he ate, and Elijah then miraculously was sustained. He ran to Horeb. Horeb is the mountain of God, it says here. That's Sinai, again. Okay, so God then visited there to Elijah on Sinai to strengthen him spiritually. And this is where I want you to notice 1 Kings 19, 11 to 12. God told Elijah, go out and stand on the mount before the Lord, and then this, and behold, the Lord passed by. And a great strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. Again, contrast there. God's not in the wind, the earthquake, or the fire. Where is he? God came to Elijah in a low whisper. And then God ministered to Elijah's spiritual weakness by speaking to him. When he speaks to him with gentleness and tenderness and mercy. What happened after that? First, verse 14, God listened there to Elijah's complaint. Elijah complains before God. He says, I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. That's a sign of his discouragement, isn't it? He's not the only one, but he feels like he's the only one. When you're discouraged, you know how often you feel lonely? You feel like you're the only one at the task? So he's feeling completely alone. He's a little bit distorted in his viewpoint. And then God ministered to Elijah. He speaks words of direction, words of comfort, words of assurance. Verse 15 to 18, God told him to anoint kings. He told him to anoint Elisha, his successor. God assured him of coming justice. God assured him of the remnant there. And I think, I believe it's verse 18, yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel. All the knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. In other words, Ahab and Jezebel won't be around forever. Justice will come. God, he's still, right, Nick, still working his justice right now, still working his justice. Elijah, your work is almost finished here. Your successor is already on the scene. So no, you're not alone, Elijah. There remains a faithful remnant. Again, just notice how God ministered to Elijah. Notice how he ministered to Moses. And with those two men in mind, those two scenes, I'd like to ask you just a couple questions. Let's consider these two men, and don't consider them as mighty prophets, Israel's leaders, giants of the faith, Moses and Elijah who appeared with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, eschatological figures as well. Don't consider them that way. Just consider them as believing men like you. Okay? Elijah was a man of a nature like ours, James says, James 5:17. They aren't superheroes. They're believing men with weaknesses like we have. But like us, they also have theological minds. They have shepherding hearts. They are called by God to lead and to teach, and they had needs. So, here's the first question. In their time of weakness and frailty and need, what did Moses and Elijah think that they needed? As they called out to God in their weakness, what did they think they needed? Okay? Could be different answers here, but let's hear a few things what you think there. First Nick, then Joe.
God's power.
They needed God's power. Okay, elaborate on that.
Well, so in the middle of all this, so they're both faced with a task too immense for them, and they feel alone up against the odds, and they need God's power to do something miraculous.
Okay. God's power, omnipotence, that's what they need. An incommunicable attribute. I need power. I would too. I would think the same thing. Joe?
To know God and to know what he knows, to know that it's going to be, that he's going to, still got a plan, that he's going to carry it through.
Okay, good. So tapping into the omniscience of God, but that omniscience made kind of relevant for the situation, okay, applied to the situation, good.
So yeah, the power to trust in him, and
okay,
depend on him.
Okay, so they were looking for the power to trust in him, their own power, to trust that he would empower them or strengthen them to trust in him. Good. Yeah, Josh and Wayne.
I think they want to see and understand his plan, because it's not just what's he doing, because it's not just his power. It's they know he has the power, because Moses just saw God and the Ten Commandments and that whole experience and how amazing that is. Elijah just saw fire from heaven, and so for it to look like things aren't going well with a God who can do that, it just doesn't make sense.
Okay, good. Thank you for articulating that. So they need to know, they need to make sense of everything. They need to know God's plan in the moment. What are you going to do? Help me to understand this. Help me to understand why all my leadership up to this point has led to rampant idolatry, led to dancing around calves, throwing down your altars. Help me to understand this. And notice neither of them are saying, wipe out Israel. Yeah, go ahead, just nuke them. They're not saying that.
The opposite of that, especially with
right.
Moses.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
Yeah, don't do it. Even Elijah, I mean, he's praying for the right things. He's like, I alone have been zealous for your glory. I mean, he still loves God's glory. He wants, and what's breaking his heart is that nobody else is seeing it that way. Nobody else loves the glory of God. Good. So help me to understand, make sense of this. Is that what you're going to say, Wayne?
Yeah, that's what I've got written down. His power, they're looking for his reassurance, and they're looking for a view of his plan.
Okay, good, good. James?
Kind of pull off of what Josh is saying. Like Paul wished himself to be a curse for his people. Moses was the same way. He's like, if you're going to blot them out, you might as well blot me out too.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely love that. You know, a leader has a true heart for his people.
Yeah.
Even to being damned for all eternity.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's an incredible level of growth and maturity, isn't it? It's hard for us to say that. Yeah, Joe?
His presence, I think. He needed to know that God was there and he was going to be there in the future.
Okay,
you know,
good.
Moses would talk to God about that. You know, are you going to go with me?
His presence. Yeah, I need your presence. I need you to be with me. But what about his presence? Did he want?
All that other stuff.
All the other stuff.
All the other stuff.
Good. That's a theological category called. All that other stuff. It's in that bucket right there. Yeah, I get it. It's a great category. That's all. In their weakness and their frailty and their need, this is what they think they needed, but what did God give them? And if God gave them this, what did they actually need? Because God gives them what they actually need, not what they think they need. What did God give them? Okay.
Grace, mercy.
Okay, grace, mercy. Brad?
He also just gave rest and strength.
Yeah.
And it fed the physical need there. The very basics of this is how you're going to get back up. So.
Rest, replenishment. Yeah, just a refreshment, right?
He gave them a peace with himself.
Gave them peace? Good. Okay. You think about, again, I just think about the father with the sons, you know, playing on the football field and got them out there. They've been doing 2 days and tackling drills and everything else. And sometimes as a father, you just step in and say, hey, blow the whistle, timeout. Come over here and get some water. You know, sit down on the bench for a bit, stock, yuck it up, you know. Now we can get back in the game once you're refreshed, right? Good. Josh, and then, okay, wait. I keep missing. This is Jordan. I know, but I keep saying Jared. Sorry. Let's start with Josh and then come to you.
This is, feels bad after the rest thing, but he also gives them direction of what to do next.
Yeah. He does explain the plan, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Jordan.
I think he gives them, like, assurance because he's not telling them, like, it's going to be all right. He tells Elijah to just, like, leave, just, like, rest in what God has told him.
Yeah. So he gives them assurance about what?
Who he is.
But, basically God's all-powerful and their issue is more than what he can see.
Okay, great. So assurance that from his perspective, God can see everything. It's going to be okay. I've got this in hand. Go, anoint, do this, take care of this. Because there's a plan that Elijah can't see from his limited perspective. God's up there seeing all things, executing everything. Nothing's taken God by surprise. All the false worship and idolatry and everything, it's not shocking God as if he didn't have it already in his plan, in his decree. Good. Let's come back over here. I can see your hand. But Nicholas, I passed over to you, Russ.
Yeah, God gave him a new start in both situations, not just more direction, but it's like they got a new start.
Okay. Yeah, so like he lifted them up, set them on their feet again. So here, and it kind of pointed them in the right direction. Yeah, go this way. Nicholas, you're going to say?
A couple of things that I like about the one with Elijah specifically are the right before that with the two displays of power, but God was not in it. And then the still small voice, and that's where God displayed himself. So it was
good.
And it's there's like a calming that God wanted to do for him. And also just showing, kind of like with Moses, he wanted to display himself in the latter and not the former, where to emphasize that part of who he is, you know. But then also, the second thing is with giving him the direction and the perspective of, like, here's what I'm doing. A lot of times when I'm in a trial, I want God to, like, can you work a miracle here? Because that's what it takes, you know. But really what God does in the end is work it out over a long period of time and change things the way he always does through his providence. Mm-hmm. And it looks unmiraculous, but it's far more wise. You know?
Far more wise because he's patient. He's taken the time to instruct and teach. Yeah, exactly. And I like what you said, the first part of that, is there's a contrast between the smashing displays of power and authority and, you know, the fire, the earthquake, the wind. What did all that demonstrate? Sinai before, right? Where Moses, with, you know, God came down on the mountain with fire, blast trumpets. It was this ear-shattering, you know, disruptive display. I don't know if you've ever been in the presence of some massive explosion, but it rocks your insides. I mean, the shockwaves go through your body and you feel it. If you're too close to it, just the shockwaves will kill you. It just completely scramble your guts and you're dead. But that being at Sinai then, and now he's here again on Sinai, Elijah is, and there's a contrast. I'm not in this. I'm in this low whisper. Gary.
What's the end of both Moses and Elijah, because of what they were going through, also lost focus somewhat on God, and it was them, and God had helped them get their answer from him.
Sorry, I was coughing when you said the last part. You said they lost focus, yes, and then you said...
And God had to help them see that it wasn't them, it was him again, and you see that that's what's transformed. But I mean, it was taking care of their personal needs, and how easy that is when we're going through something to lose focus.
Yeah.
And that's the reason we're told to keep our eyes fixed on Christ, the author and finisher of our faith.
Yeah. We're all going to come to this point. We're all going to come to this point, come to the end of ourselves, and we need to come there. Yeah, it's a difficult place to be, but that's exactly what God needs to bring us through. Joe, and then I thought I saw a hand over here. Oh, Ryan, yeah.
I was just thinking that he also gives them a really intimate experience with him. Like, it's a really personal, that seems like that's the most strengthening aspect of this, is that they get that relationship, close relationship with God again.
Yeah, that is well said. So he visits them with an intimate, personal experience of his presence in relationship. In both situations, God doesn't just flex a muscle, he speaks. He speaks and he tells them something, communicates. It's really, really important. There's a relationship there. The Spirit of God communicating with the Spirit of man and refreshing him from the inside out. Really important. Ryan.
Yeah, so when Elijah fled from Jezebel's threats, you'd already touched on him, he's exhausted, and that death sentence is hanging over him, and his confidence is shaken, and just when God gives him those next steps, anoint, 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 the time that's going to take, the travel to do those things, it's restoring his confidence as those things accomplished. Yes, God's plans and it's just getting his focus back on.
Yeah. Yeah, getting back in the game. Rub some dirt on it, get back in the game. That's right. He sends him walking. Devin and then Bill, and then was there anything on this side? Okay, then we'll move on. Devin?
So Psalm 40, as David talked about this, same thing. He says, I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me out from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog, and set my feet upon a rock, keeping my steps secure. So he did the same thing with David. Same thing
with Elijah. What an awesome psalm.
Same thing with us.
Yeah, same thing. Thank you. That's great.
And this is a stretch, just so I can advertise for Sunday school class tomorrow?
Wait a minute. Are we going to give equal time?
He leaves from the local church.
Yeah.
He didn't destroy everybody. There's still 7,000 left for Elijah. There's a group left for Moses. He leaves them, these comrades, he leaves them still associations, people that believe like he does, people that will re-engage in the fight that he's going to re-engage in.
Yeah, that's really, I'm thankful you brought that out, because it is important to see that it's not just about Moses and Elijah having their own personal worship experience and kind of running off like lone wolves, just me and God tackling the universe. But there is a camaraderie, and he does connect them back to God's people. It's great. Thank you. Moses with the Levites, Elijah with the 7,000. Exactly right. Good. Sometimes number of comrades are small, but you have intimate fellowship with a small number. It's really good. So, one last question, and we'll move on. This should be a quick one for you to answer, but what attribute of God motivated, guided, determined what God gave, what God communicated to Moses and Elijah, most fundamentally? I said this ought to be a quick one.
It is omniscience.
Okay. And omniscience is, David?
gonna say gentleness.
Okay, gentleness.
It was an easy task. It, like, it wasn't something that they couldn't.
Okay, yeah, gentleness. He didn't give them something so monumental to discourage them again.
Yeah.
He gave them something that they could accomplish. Good. Okay, but what's driving even that?
Love.
Bingo. Fundamentally, what's going on? What's driving the heart of God here? It's love for them. Love for them. Back to what you said, Gary. This ought to sink in deeply with us. And hopefully as we go through these studies in the next few weeks and months, this is what's going to be the continued theme, is our need to love others. All right, and this is our, go back to Genesis 3 and what happened in the garden and what happened ever since. What is our problem? Self-centeredness. What is it that undoes all of our leadership and all of our influence and all of our teaching? Self-love. If we're gonna lead well and teach well and minister well and shepherd well, if we're gonna have the heart and the mind of God, we gotta be driven by love. We're gonna be driven by love in everything, which means, well, we're gonna get to what it means, okay? So that's what we're gonna talk about. I wanna talk about here our deepest need. Before we move on, listen, just as incredible and essential as our study of the incommunicable attributes of God has been, it's been stretching in our minds and everything, but it is foundational, necessary, prerequisite, as all that previous study has been. We've been moving to this point. This is where we need to come. Our deepest need is what Moses' deepest need, Elijah's deepest need, our deepest need is to know and understand the love of God. The love of God. Unless we think we already have a pretty good handle on this, I just want you to heed the caution of Charles Hodge. He said, quote, "The love of a holy God to sinners is the most mysterious attribute of the divine nature," end quote. I hope you believe that. And I hope you don't think that Charles Hodge is just being eloquent and exaggerating a bit. He's actually, Hodge is a very restrained writer. He's very precise, and when he says the most mysterious attribute of the divine nature, he means it. The love of a holy God to sinners is the most mysterious attribute of the divine nature. And where do we see the love of God for guilty sinners displayed? In the cross. So, again, it's right back to the gospel, you guys. It's right back to the gospel. Don't ever think, I've got a handle on the gospel, I've memorized Bill's four letters, and I've got it down, I've been through Way of the Master, I got the whole thing, I understand gospel, I'm a gospel guy, I got it. And move on. Don't think that. As much as you memorize forms and patterns and acronyms and things like that to be able to speak and communicate to others, that's a good thing. But don't think you've got it. Just go deeper. Reflect deeper still. Because you need this gospel every single day. Love of God to sinners. The love of a holy God to sinners is the most mysterious attribute of the divine nature. The hymn writer put it, "The love of God is greater far than tongue or pen can ever tell. It goes beyond the highest star and reaches to the lowest hell." That's why Paul prayed. And look over at Ephesians 3. You guys know this, but I'm going to read it anyway. Ephesians chapter 3, verses 14 to 19. This is why Paul prayed in view of all-surpassing, incomprehensible mystery, the love of God for us sinners. Paul prayed in confident hope of God's good intention. For this reason, Ephesians 3:14, "I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named, that according to the riches of his glory, he may grant you to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and the length and the height and the depth, to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God." So you have to comprehend that breadth and length and height and depth of the love of Christ. in order that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. So it's not a study of systematic theology that's going to do it. As necessary and essential and foundational prerequisite as knowledge and understanding is, you need to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, and you may be filled with all the fullness of God. It's not anti-knowledge, but it just surpasses. It goes beyond knowledge. Knowledge is a platform to understand and grow and experience and grow in wisdom in this. Again, so without denying divine simplicity or denying the need for all the attributes of God's glory, the attribute of God we most deeply need is the love of God, okay? It's through the love of God that for us that we're able to see all the other attributes of God's glory shine forth. And maybe to say it another way, without the love of God, we would not be able to see any other attribute of God's glory. We would be lost in darkness, unable to see or understand anything of God, which is, it has to be the very worst of all the torments of hell. But God has loved us. Because he's loved us, we're able to know him, to understand him, and that is the greatest treasure of all. So with that as an introduction, let's use the time that remains to talk about how we're going to organize this final stretch of studies on theology proper. I think you'll hopefully be edified even in talking about something as mundane as organization. These attributes of God's goodness. First of all, let's talk about the meaning of divine goodness. I'll describe the organization of the study on divine goodness, and then I want to try to justify it for you why we're going to organize it this way. First of all, the meaning of divine goodness. When we're talking about divine goodness, we're talking about a larger category of attributes of goodness, okay? Communicable attributes, and encompasses all these attributes that we've been mentioning. Hodge says, when we're talking about divine goodness, he says goodness, in the scriptural sense of the term, includes benevolence, love, mercy, and grace. Okay? Goodness includes benevolence, love, mercy, and grace. Listen to this, just as he unpacks those terms a little bit. By benevolence is meant the disposition to promote happiness. All sensitive creatures are its objects. Okay, so happiness not maybe in the American sense of unrestrained license to do whatever I want, but happiness in a biblical sense, you could say is the word blessedness, okay? Chesed, that's mercy, but take happiness in the New Testament as makarios, blessedness, happiness. Happiness is not a bad thing, as long as we define it biblically. Benevolence, by benevolence is meant the disposition in God to promote our happiness. All sensitive creatures are its objects. Love includes complacency, desire, and delight, and has rational beings for its objects. Are you a rational being?
Sometimes.
Mercy is kindness, exercised towards the miserable, and includes pity, compassion, forbearance, and gentleness, which the scriptures so abundantly ascribe to God. So we're thinking about the concept of gentleness and kindness. It's kind of all wrapped up in mercy. And then grace is love exercised toward the unworthy. Love exercised toward the unworthy. So along with those just mentioned attributes, Louis Burkhoff includes two others. He talks about the general goodness of God, which he describes in terms of his dealing bountifully and kindly with all of his creatures, like generosity, kindness. But also, so there's this bountiful kindness that he deals with his creatures in goodness, but also goodness means the long-suffering of God. So particularly in his patience with patient forbearance with the disobedient, okay? That's all of us. He's patiently forbearing our disobedience toward him. Listen to this quote from Burkhoff. He explains more fully what he means by the goodness of God. This is an important important complement to what Hodge just said. The goodness of God should not be confused with his kindness, which is a more restricted concept. We speak of something as good when it answers in all parts to the ideal. Hence, in our ascription of goodness to God, the fundamental idea is that he is in every way all that he as God should be, and therefore answers perfectly to the ideal expressed in the word God. He is good in the metaphysical sense of the word, absolute perfection and perfect bliss in himself. It is in this sense that Jesus said to the young ruler, "None is good save one, even God," Mark 10:18. But since God is good in himself, he is also good for his creatures, and may therefore be called the fons omnium bonorum. He is the fountain of all good, and so represented in a variety of ways throughout the Bible. The poet sings, "For with thee is the fountain of life. In thy light shall we see light." Psalm 36:9. All the good things which the creatures enjoy in the present and expect in the future flow to them out of this inexhaustible fountain. And not only that, but God is also the summum bonum, the highest good for all his creatures, though in different degrees and according to the measure in which they answer to the purpose of their existence. Okay, so those words that he uses to describe the goodness of God, he answers perfectly to the ideal, which is himself. He is absolute perfection. He's perfect bliss in himself. He's the fons omnium bonorum, the fountain of all good. He's the summum bonum, the highest good. All those descriptions are really trying in vain to convey the glory of God. Glory. That's what the goodness of God is about, as we were talking about that. It's about his glory. Okay? So first we're talking about God's goodness, divine goodness. The second, since love and goodness and glory are so inextricably linked, I want to describe the organization of our study of divine goodness and take a few minutes to justify then why we're going to study it this way, okay? So let me describe the organization of divine goodness and how we're going to approach this in our study in the coming weeks and months. First of all, we're going to study what theologians call the blessedness of God. The blessedness of God, you might... I don't want to just say it this way, but the happiness of God, the joy of God being God, but the blessedness of God in his own goodness, in his own glory. God in 1 Timothy 6:15 is the blessed and only sovereign. Okay, we want to understand that. So we're going to walk through why God is blessed in being God, why God is blessed in his own goodness and glory due to the perfection of his own goodness. So when we talk about perfection, we're talking about completeness, integrity, whole, comprehensiveness. We want to talk about the weight of his own goodness, significance, gravity, profundity, the weight. We're going to talk about the beauty of his own goodness, so things like excellence, splendor, magnificence, loveliness. Talk about the blessedness of his goodness, the joy, contentment, happiness, gladness, delight in his goodness. And then the pleasure of his own goodness. All that you think about with pleasure, satisfaction, desire, longing. Longing is probably the wrong word, but the pleasure of his own goodness. Okay? So we're going to study first the blessedness of God in his own goodness, in his own glory. Second, we're going to study the love of God for his own goodness and glory, which means we're going to start with the love of God for God. That's where the love of God is going to start, an inner Trinitarian love. Then we're going to study the love of God for us, which is a condescending love. Love of God for us is going to propel us into the rest of our study of systematic theology. So all the other ologies that come out of this is going to be propelled and founded on this issue of the love of God. So let me ask, why should we study the blessedness of God and being God first before we study the love of God?
Well, he's got to have reasons to be happy in why he is God, so it would be fundamental to studying that.
Okay. Reasons, say that again, reasons
well,
for God being happy in God?
If he's happy about being God, what reasons are there that make that case, I guess.
Okay, all right. So if he's happy in being God, which he is, there's no disappointment in his being God, like, oh man, gotta be God again. No. He is very blessed in being God, and the most contented, joyful being in the universe. What are those reasons? What compels that? Yeah, Josh, and then come back.
Just quickly, studying the love of God for us, apart from studying the love of God for God, makes us think more man-centered. Makes us think it's about us, makes us okay with, like, I'm giving, there was a Babylon Bee article this week that said that woman decides to leave church because God loves her so much she doesn't need it, or something like that. I'm not sure why she needs to listen to sermons anymore. It causes us to think of how great we are, that God would love us. Amen.
So studying the love of God for us, apart from studying the love of God for God, it promotes further our own inherited nature of man-centeredness, which actually undermines the whole cause, doesn't it? Because the more centered we are on ourselves, the more unhappy we are. Wayne and then Brett.
Yeah, go back to your quote from Charles Hodge, right? The love of a holy God to sinners is the most mysterious attribute of the divine nature, right? If we accept that, if that's the case, if we truly believe that, then one of the implications of that is that we can't really get at the concept in a comprehensive way directly, right? We need to make sure that we start with the foundation of how God views his own creation, how God views himself, how God views his own plans. And through that gives you a foundation where you can start to see some of the reasons in himself for that condescension. We may not ever fully comprehend it, right? But we see the hints that lead us along the path.
Okay, good. So finding, which is that they're finding the reasons in God himself that extends his love toward us. That's very, very important. Brett?
Yeah, I was just going to say, everybody said it kind of, but it's just like, we think of love, we cannot conceive of love without some sort of need in the beloved, you know, of a need for ourselves in the beloved. And God doesn't have that. We know that. But if you study the blessedness of God in himself, then that becomes more palpable, like how he doesn't need us, and yet he, like you were saying, the foundation in himself that caused him to condescend to us, because it is mysterious, because we don't understand why if he doesn't need us, then why did he create us?
Because we're born into this world in sin, and so even the best intentions of our love seem to have a lot of self-interest involved, don't they?
We never get one iota better.
We're ashamed to say, but it does, we do see that. We do see such imperfections. And so if we go back and study the perfection of love in God being God, an intratrinitarian love where there is no need, there's no one person of the Trinity, the desires of something in the other person of the Trinity that person doesn't have, because they all share the divine essence, consubstantial, there's no need in God. What compels him to love intertrinitarian? What compels him to love then outside of yourself? If we understand that better, we're going to just, I think, come into a whole other understanding of him, our relationship to him, our relationship with one another, things as fundamental as our relationship with our wives, with our children, with others around us. We need to learn this. Okay, Gary?
Yeah, it goes back to where you started today. You talked about whether or not we come to know things but through communicable versus incommunicable attributes. And we came to understand that we see it through communicable attributes. That's why God has those. But the foundation is the incommunicable, and it's a similar argument here. I understand the incommunicable first as the foundation for the rest of it. So we've come
from... Okay, good. Okay, so good. We got to set a foundation in God to have any study about anything toward us. Good. Excellent. Good. One more, Nick. Are you raising your hand or just stretching? You're like, no, don't call on me.
I got you covered.
I'm just thinking from a philosophical perspective too. Philosophers, people throughout the ages have wrestled with the concept of good. What exactly is that? And where does it come from? But they also have to speak in terms of good and bad, right and wrong. But
they keep on borrowing from our worldview, don't they?
Yeah, I know. And they, but when you look at James, you know, he says, all good and perfect gifts come down from the Father of lights, with whom there's no variation, shifting shadow. Mm-hmm. And God is the source of good. So to understand good at all, we have to go back to its metaphysical basis, you know, and understand that.
Metaphysical basis, which is?
God.
God is the metaphysical reality, the source of all being, the pure being. We need to understand him first. Good. Okay, so you guys are all on the right track. Let's justify this a little bit. Justifying the organization of divine goodness into first blessedness and then talk about love. First, God's blessedness in being God and his own goodness, his own glory, before we talk about God's love of God and then us. Okay? So the first point of justification has to do with the definition of love. Anybody want to take a stab at defining love? Make it very quick. Love is... Okay, you don't want to do it. All right? So think about love as giving. Love is giving. When Wayne Grudem defines love, he uses a definition that I've been pretty familiar with. I think you all are too. God's love, he says, means that God eternally gives of himself to others. That's simple, to the point. God's love means God eternally gives him of himself to others. And then he goes on to say, this definition understands love as self-giving for the benefit of others. MacArthur and Mayhew, in their biblical doctrine, they write, God's perfect love is his determination to give of himself and to others, and it is his affection for himself and his people. Okay, so I like that because it's more... I mean, Grudem says others, almost pushing it outside of God, but I like the way MacArthur and Mayhew say, there's also God's love for God and God's love for others. So God's perfect love, determination to give of himself and to others, his affection for himself and for his people. Okay? So that's love is giving. Theologians, though, also speak of love as communicating. And this is why when you see God's dealing with Moses and Elijah, what's he doing? Communicating. What is communicating? It's love. It's love. When Burkhoff defined love of God, he said, it is that perfection of God by which he is eternally moved to self-communication. Eternally moved to self-communication. So before we talk about God's inclination for eternal movement to communicate, it's really important that we find out what he's so zealous and exuberant to communicate, namely, himself. God rejoices in being God. When we find out why, we're going to have a better platform for understanding what compels his love to communicate. Okay? That brings us to a second point of justification, which goes back to, we talked first about the definition of love, that means we want to talk about blessedness first and then love, just by the definition of love, but also the description of love, and particularly the description by Hodge. You may have missed it. We read through this kind of quickly, but let me read it again. He said, love includes complacency, desires, and delight, and has rational beings for its objects. Okay, I read that earlier. On the next page, Hodge finds something analogous in our love to the love of God. And he writes, love in us includes complacency and delight in its object with the desire of possession and communion. That's love in us. Is there any word in Hodge's sentences that has you scratching your head a bit?
Complacency.
Complacency. Me too. So I looked it up. What is complacency? According to what do you think complacency is? Passivity, I'm good, apathy, I'm not going to lift a finger to help because I'm complacent. as Webster's New Universal Unabridged Dictionary says, the noun complacency refers to, quote, a feeling of quiet pleasure or security. And again, it's defining it not based on God but us, so our own human experience, but a feeling of quiet pleasure or security, often while unaware of some potential danger, defect, or the like. Self, another definition or part of that, is self-satisfaction or smug satisfaction with an existing situation. Same source says the adjective complacent means pleased, especially with oneself or one's merits, advantages, situation, etc., often without awareness of some potential danger or defect. Self-satisfied. So how does complacency describe not just us or complacent people, but describe the love of God? Why is that a really good word? I was going to say, but Wayne, go ahead.
Because he continues to give of himself and is happy to do so, ignoring or at least forbearing the persistent challenge, trouble, and consequences at times of our sin.
Okay, so you're seeing it in the way he exercises love, being in complacency, because like us, how is it when you express love to others and it's not reciprocated? Does that kind of take the wind out of yourselves real quick?
Yeah.
I pour myself into you, and all you do is rebuff it, you know, unrequited love.
Like Moses and the people, you know.
It's like church ministry. diminishment on any church ministry or let's say marriage. How much is marriage going back and forth and loving the other person, but no matter how it's received, no matter what you get out of it. But notice how when we don't get something out of it, how quickly it's like, forget them, you know? And we want to move on. I'm going to love someone who deserves it.
Bachelor monk.
Exactly. Yeah. Go sit on the mountain. Yeah.
Right. As I listen to all this, I think about Philippians 2. Mm-hmm. And it says, even though he existed in the form of God,
yeah,
did not consider himself equal to God, but taking the form of a bondservant, even to the, you know, even death on the cross.
Right.
But at the end, it also says, whereby God also highly exalted him. And so I think that reminds us about how God has reached down to us.
Again, he didn't find something in us so desirable, attractive, something needful in himself that he needed to, I heard this just the other day, someone preaching and once again said, you know, God so loved you. He just wanted a relationship with you. He wanted, and there's a truth to that. But again, apart from God's love of God, it's very man-centered. It makes it sound like there's this aching need in God, a big U-shaped hole in his heart. Just needs a hug from you. So complacency, how does it describe the love of God? The love of God, it says, includes complacency, desires, and delight, has rational beings for its objects. So in other words, God's love, God is completely self-satisfied. That's what complacency means. He is completely self-satisfied. He desires and delights in his own goodness, in his own glory, a quiet pleasure and security in himself. Unaware of some potential danger. Of course, God is the most powerful being in the universe, with all power, omniscient. If there was any attack coming against him, he saw it coming. He's got no problems. So he's unaware of any danger. No defect, nothing like that. He is completely complacent in himself. So self-satisfaction describes God. And he's the only being in the universe that deservedly, rightly, appropriately is self-satisfied. The only being in the universe for whom self-love is absolutely appropriate. He's completely self-satisfied. He desires and delights in his own goodness and glory, and us sinful human beings are ready to accuse him of being selfish. Because that's how it would be for us, any of us. But he's not like us. So he delights in his own goodness, his own glory, in that perfect, entirely proper orientation to his own goodness and glory. It's in that that he gives, he communicates, having rational beings like the persons of the Trinity, the angelic hosts, human beings, mankind, as the objects of his love. So again, how does all of this justify setting the blessedness of God in divine goodness and glory before setting the love of God for divine goodness and glory? Well, when we get a better understanding of the reason for God's self-satisfaction, for God's self-desire, for God's self-delight, we'll better understand what compels his love. When we better understand what compels his love, being rooted and grounded in love, we're going to better appreciate and even have strength to comprehend with all the saints what's the breadth and length and height and depth to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge, so that we may be filled with all the fullness of God. That's the mystery of God's love that we're talking about. We're going to be wading into that. We've already started, jumped into the pool, but we're going to be wading into that in the coming weeks and months.